Systemic problems require systemic solutions. You're listening to the Next System podcast, a weekly series published by the Democracy Collaborative's Next System Project. This podcast seeks to understand contemporary challenges, interrogate emerging possibilities, and begin imagining the next system. You can learn more about the Next System Project at www.thenextsystem.org. And here is your host, Adam Simpson.
And welcome to the Next System Podcast. I am Isaiah J. Poole, filling in for Adam Simpson. This episode, we are talking about the Community Reinvestment Act. It's a law since the late 1970s that's compelled banks to publicly account for the investments that they make in the low and moderate income communities in which they operate. That law today is at a crossroads between conservatives and financial industry leaders who want to weaken the law and communities who say the public should be demanding more of the banking sector, not less. We have a great group of people to talk about what do banks owe our communities and what is the best way to hold the financial sector accountable for what they should be doing for our communities. Here with us today is Devin Case Uchala. Devin is a graduate student at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, who is pursuing a doctorate in the political economy of finance. Devin has an extensive background in the cooperative sector, and Devin prefers to pronounce they, them, and their. Devin has written a new working paper and resource guide that is currently on the homepage of our website, thenextsystem.org. It's called A Next System of Community Investment, Community Reinvestment Act Reform in the 21st Century. Devin, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Also with us is John Holtzclaw from the National Cooperative Bank, where he is Senior Vice President of Corporate Affairs. Part of his job there is to promote and advance social investment opportunities in ways that further the National Cooperative Bank's commitment to mission banking. John, I'm really glad to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
And we have Gregory Jost. He is a man with many hats. One of those hats is Director of Organizing at Banana Kelly Community Improvement Association in the South Bronx. He is also a partner at Designing the We, which is a social impact design studio collaborating with community groups to undesign structural racism and systemic equality. Thank you for joining us, Gregory.
It's good to be here.
Let me start with Devin and this working paper that you've written. I think it would be helpful to start with, what is the significance of the Community Reinvestment Act? And why do you think it's important to have a conversation about this law at this particular time?
Sure. So the CRA was a law that was passed in 1977 to address the issue of redlining. And it's been a hugely important law in terms of getting banks to lend more equitably. So the law originally said that a bank that takes deposits in a lower income area can't just take that money and invest it only in a higher income area. Rather, it needs to make an effort to lend equitably in the communities in which they operate. And at the time that the law was passed, the main mechanism by which the CRA requirements were activated was through the actual bank branches. Now, of course, banks are no longer significantly branch-based. Rather, the financial industry as a whole has moved away from just simple deposit taking, especially through branches, and then lending out in long-term sustainable investments. And so the importance of thinking about the CRA now, right now at this time, is to understand to what extent is it able to really do what it was intended to do, given structural and ideological changes in the banking industry that have more aligned banks structurally and ideologically with capital markets, with the shadow banking industry, and move their focus away from communities. Now, despite that, the banking industry has moved away from a branch-based focus, a community-based focus, bank deposits still constitute $12 trillion in assets. That is a huge, huge amount of wealth that could be going towards communities, and the CRA is one tool that can be used to do that, a significant tool, perhaps one of the only tools by which communities can actually call on banks to reinvest money. And there are various avenues through which communities are able to do that. So in a nutshell, CRA, especially now the OCC has come out with an annual notice of proposed rulemaking.
The OCC is the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, which is in the Treasury Department.
Thank you. Yes. there's an opportunity right now for regulatory changes, and there's been a proposed legislation by Senator Elizabeth Warren to modernize the CRA. So it's important to understand the CRA, what it's doing right now in the baking industry, and how we can modernize it.
Right. And we'll get to those a little bit later in the podcast. Gregory, I want to talk to you because you're there in the South Bronx and you've been on the front lines of economic development there in the South Bronx. What's your perspective on what the Community Investment Act has done, what differences it has made, and what difference it has not made?
Great question. So when CRA was passed, it was an era of mass disinvestment, both by the private sector and the public sector. You had bank redlining, insurance redlining, and you had policies of planned shrinkage that were really piloted in New York City and the South Bronx, where they closed fire stations in the exact neighborhoods where there was an increase in the number of fires. And folks were fighting back because their neighborhoods were literally burning down. And when their actual first real battle was for what they called home mortgage disclosure. That was the rallying cry starting out of Chicago, and they passed a mortgage disclosure bill in the state of Illinois, and then they fought for it on a national level in place. It was part of these coalitions that were in places like the Bronx, in Baltimore, Cleveland, Syracuse, you know, a lot of working class, mixed race neighborhoods that would be redlined because there was this racial change happening. And that, you know, that's a lot of the origins of redlining come out of that idea that we can't have working class mixed race neighborhoods and that because they're too risky. So when, after they got home mortgage disclosure passed in 75, there was an era of kind of like, well, what do we do next with this? And a lot of the folks on the ground really thought that they could just push banks on their own. But after CRA was passed, which was kind of really came out of the vision of some folks in the Senate and Senator Proxmire and such, but it provided this really great tool to actually hold banks accountable for doing what they should have been doing all along. Though in the early years, the challenge was, how do we get CRA to work for our neighborhoods? And this was the point in time where folks were taking over their buildings either through sweat equity or through, you know, passing a hat and saying, we're going to turn this into a community controlled piece of housing. And we had groups all over the Bronx, all over the city, all over the country, looking for investment to be able to rehab these buildings and homes. These are buildings that didn't have boilers. So they had been stripped in different ways because the landlords were, you know, stripping whatever they could out of them. And so they used and leveraged CRA as much as they could to be able to bring some investment back into their neighborhoods. And it started very slowly, but there were some big key moments. There's one story in the 80s where Citibank was actually closing a branch on West Kingsbridge Road. And they had sent out this get moving kit to all their customers, which included folks who were organizing in the Northwest Bronx at the time. And it was saying, we're moving to Westchester. You should too, you know, come stop in for a home loan about moving, you know, for buying a house in the suburbs. And meanwhile, they're trying to close their branch. And so folks were organizing and they said, you know, we're going to try to stop. And they actually did. They went to Paul Volcker and they were able to stop the expansion of Citibank into the credit card business for about a year because of this branch closing. So that was one of these really interesting stories of how they could leverage the power of this law to, in the end, it was a loss because that branch still closed, but they were able to keep another branch still open a few blocks away that's still there today. So, you know, there's some losses, some victories in there, but the big picture of it is that CRA's allowed community organizations the access to capital to do these acquisition, renovations, new construction of housing and rebuild physical infrastructure in neighborhoods that were decimated. And over time, it's become known to the banking industry that a lot of this lending can be very profitable, and a lot of the work that they can do, it looks good and it feels good. And it's again, like I said, it's rebuilt neighborhoods. However,
but what is not happening?
Yeah, exactly. That's the critical piece here is right there. There's a certain type of investment that comes in through CRA, but it misses a lot because it's built on this existing structure that it never really addressed in terms of like the underlying systemic inequality that was there and the systemic racism. So as the neighborhoods become rebuilt and more desirable, we see this pattern that's happened for many generations of serial displacement continuing. So the investment that comes in fails to invest in folks on the ground who actually live in the neighborhood. It doesn't build wealth or ownership for folks in any kind of intentional way. And so as a neighborhood improves, you see that instead of the rising tide lifting all boats, you see the floodwaters coming in and washing away folks who have been the historically redlined people. So we still have folks who have very low to no to negative wealth, who don't own anything, who struggle to make their rent payments or mortgage payments, who spend over 50-60% of their income on rent. We have a lot of folks who've been displaced multiple times, who've been pushed from one neighborhood to the next, and end up in a place like the Bronx because it's the last kind of option in New York City before you get bumped out all the way out of the city. And, you know, and we still have all these other massive disparities in terms of everything from health disparities to education disparities to incarceration disparities. We know, like, it hasn't addressed any of that. And exactly. That might be asking a lot out of it. It wasn't really designed to address all those things. But we know that in the context in which it arises, if we think about it as an anti-redlining law, the potential for it is so much greater than what's there right now.
So let me go to John, because you actually have a national cooperative bank that you are a part of. How is your work affected by the Community Reinvestment Act, and what shortcomings do you see?
So from a historical standpoint, CRA was created and signed into law in 1977. The National Cooperative Bank was congressionally chartered in 1978, and one of the things as a part of that charter, and what a lot of people don't know, is that the bank has a mandate that 35% of all of our disbursements be in low and moderate income communities. So the idea of us wanting to work in those communities is already baked into the cake to some degree. And so as years have gone on, this mission has really become a large part of the DNA of the organization. And so CRA, while it's very valuable to us, it doesn't deter us or encourage us to do what we've been mandated to do. So with that said, I mean, we try to use CRA and other opportunities to work in LMI communities to advance the rise of cooperative development. You know, we're starting to see more now in some of our lending in the co-op grocery world, where we're seeing a growth in both the urban and the rural areas. Again, you probably will hear the word access throughout this entire podcast. Again, giving access to folks healthy foods who don't necessarily have them in these communities. And this goes along the spectrum of, you know, predominantly white communities, predominantly African-American communities, as well as on the home ownership side. We just actually recently finished a transaction that is going to allow there to be not necessarily larger share loans, but smaller share loans being the loans that are used to finance housing cooperatives. And so, you know, for many years, government restrictions on resales and other things have made it hard for low-income families to own cooperative housing or be a part of a cooperative housing. And so it's limited the amount of limited equity co-ops around the country. And so there again, we're hoping that by providing these smaller share loans, that it can increase the number of limited equity co-ops in New York and Chicago and other places across the country. And then I would just say, you know, lastly, we're starting to see more now, you know, just a need for there to be more education around cooperatives. You know, I spent many of my years walking the halls of Congress. I always tell people that I'm a reformed political junkie, but you would talk to staffers about cooperatives and they would have no idea what you're talking about. And then you say, well, are you a member of the Congressional Credit Union or the Senatorial Federal Credit Union? Well, yes, I am. I'm a proud member. And you let them know, well, that's a cooperative. You're joining as a member, not necessarily as a client or a person with an account there. And so then the light goes off. And so what it's done for us, it's just created an opportunity for us to continue doing the mission lending that we've done since our inception, but also to educate those around the cooperative principles and development that we see. So very important to combat what Gregory was saying, the structural inequalities in some of these communities and many of these communities that we serve.
Devin, one of the things that was really, you really emphasized in this working paper was the notion of community wealth building as a missing element in what the Community Reinvestment Act does. Explain what you mean.
Sure. So the CRA framework, so the original law really didn't have much guidance on how banks were supposed to be examined. That came in a 1995 reform, which implemented the bank exams, which evaluate banks on their activities in lending, investing, and providing certain services to low and moderate income communities. And as part of that, there's a whole set of criteria that is outlined in what's called the interagency Q&As. I don't know why it's called that, but that's where you go to find the qualifying criteria. And what's specified there is a focus on mortgage lending to individual low and moderate income borrowers and small business lending to low and moderate income borrowers, which is loans under $1 million. And then there is an expansion of that definition, but that's kind of the basic definition. And what I heard through talking with some people that have worked with the CRA, and I'd be interested to hear what else Gregory has to add to this, is that there are limits to how far that impact can go, and the types of projects that end up going into communities maybe not aren't necessarily building lasting community wealth. And so the focus on community wealth building was just to say that there's an opportunity to build on these criteria to really specifically call out the role of certain types of community development models, like the community wealth building models, co-ops, land trusts, social enterprise, call those out explicitly in the criteria to say these are wealth building models that are even more effective at, or can be more effective at, building lasting wealth in communities.
Otherwise, what we're doing is encouraging banks to put money into communities in ways that end up pushing people out of communities.
Sure. And there are some, there are criteria that specify mixed income housing to try to mitigate the gentrification that can happen and certain types of housing projects come into low-income communities, but the extent to which the criteria, the higher impact projects are actually emphasized, is a matter of the broader evaluation process. So banks can kind of get away with doing less, even though there are the higher impact projects on that list. And this gets into the reforms of why we need better enforcement mechanisms, which we'll get to later, I'm sure.
And also, one statistic in your report stands out, which is something like, correct me if I'm wrong, 98% of banks get favorable Community Reinvestment Act ratings?
That's correct. They get a satisfactory rating or greater or outstanding rating. But it's like 89% get satisfactory, which only leaves about 10% that's getting an outstanding rating.
Let me ask Gregory there, do 89% or 98% of the banks that are operating in the South Bronx operate satisfactorily?
First, there's not that many banks even operating in the South Bronx. That's the first thing. And so if you want to talk about like branch distribution, no. And that's only one small piece. But, you know, what Devin's making the point, and it's very true, is like it's so easy to pass. You have to be really, really bad. And when I say you have to be really bad, you know, you look at all the huge mega banks. They're going to invest a ton of money here and there, but they're also simultaneously extracting wealth out of our neighborhoods, out of our communities. And things that they invest in, like all around in the whole world of global capitalism right now, that part doesn't get considered hardly at all. I think even, and Devin, you probably can speak to this better, but even Wells Fargo, with some of the troubles they got in before, was like a kind of a slap on the wrist. Like, you need to do this and change this, and then you'll still get a really great rating. So So the bar is set so low. Some of the only times that a bank actually gets kind of worse than satisfactory is if they're specifically engaged in like blatant racial discrimination, redlining, and they're a small bank, so they can't make up for that in other ways. So there's very little to what's actually being measured at this point in time that has much teeth to it. Now, we have been able to have some success with some of the, so we have a state regulator in New York State, because there are a lot of New York State chartered banks. It's the Department of Financial Services. We ran a project a number of years ago that I helped lead, where we created this data set to evaluate the physical and financial distress of basically every New York City apartment building. And we did that through pulling data on code violations, if they owed taxes and water and sewer, if they were structural issues in the building. And then we also pulled mortgage data. And what we did was we were able to, from a systemic level, look at what's the quality of the loans that each bank is making, and then go to the regulators. And we started with Department of Financial Services, and FDIC also came on board to a certain extent, to start looking at, in the CRA exams, can we stop counting loans made in these, qualifying low and moderate income census tracts that are actually going to questionable types of actors, what you might call a slumlord. And in fact, we got the governor of New York State to announce these as slumlord prevention guidelines. So that was the first step. And since then, Department of Financial Services has actually gone a step further and looks at whether or not the loans, the buildings that the banks are putting forth as asking for qualifying as CRA investment, is there displacement happening? Or is this landlord coming in and pushing out tenants, low rent tenants, lower income tenants, to bring higher income, higher rent paying tenants in? And if they can demonstrate that, well, basically what they're doing is putting the onus on the bank to say that this is not happening.
Right. Well, but the key point of what you've just said there is that you were able to do that because you had state elected officials who were willing to go to bat for that.
Yeah.
If you happen to live in a state like Georgia, for example, say you're living in Atlanta, you may not have that benefit.
No. And there was a lot of organizing to push for that. There was the data and advocacy work, and there was on the ground organizing. This all happened. It came out of the last housing bubble collapse, where we had buildings going into foreclosure. We had a couple buildings in the Bronx go vacant for the first time in decades. So there was a ton of organizing work that pushed for it. But yeah, you have to have the electeds that are willing to listen and put right. their money where their mouth is. But we believe that this set a precedent in saying that, look, it is possible for regulators to go the extra mile and think about what's the real intent around CRA. And like, it's not really a stick. There's not a punishment to the banks for actually doing some of that harmful type of lending. They just don't get to count those loans for their benefit. So it's, while it's something that we really feel like it can go further.
Exactly. So let's talk to Devin, and let's talk about what are the specific things that you've been raising up that would raise the bar.
Well, there's quite a range of options that are available. There are reforms that can be made within the current regulatory framework, and there are reforms that are arguably the more fundamental ones that we really want to shoot for, but that are going to require legislative change. And those are reforms that would expand the CRA to non-depository institutions, so to banks that aren't taking deposits, or rather financial institutions that aren't taking deposits. For example, online financial institutions or online banks, mortgage affiliates that are part of a bank holding company, there's a problem of banks that used to, the types of activities that banks do are moving into the mortgage affiliates that are part of the same bank holding company that are not regulated by the CRA. So they're able to do mortgage lending without being subject to CRA.
That would be the Quicken Loans of the world, right?
Sure. And there are efforts to put pressure on regulatory agencies to look at that more closely, but an explicit expansion to those institutions would require legislative change.
Okay.
And So within the current regulatory framework, there's changes to the community development criteria, what requires as loans, investments, and services that qualify for CRA loans and services. There is changing the definition of community development so that it's not just small business lending and mortgage lending. It's kind of a more holistic focus on equity. Weirdly, even though the CRA was originally intended to address redlining, there's no explicit mention of banks lending to people of color. That is something that we definitely want to be added. And then there's leveraging the role of the regulatory agencies, so putting more pressure on the agencies to get more involved. They are the ones responsible for training examiners. They also have community development offices, but sometimes those two sets of offices are not really in conversation with one another. So community, so for example, the Fed, community development divisions there recognize community wealth building models are a new form of community development that are creating more meaningful impact. But whether or not that's actually making its way into evaluating bank performance via the examiners, mixed at best, or it's not happening. And so calling on the regulatory agencies to do more to integrate that understanding and also to bring greater understanding to banks and communities of the cooperative development models and projects that are available for banks to be investing in and how those can qualify as CRA. So that's all kind of within the current regulatory framework. There's also improving the overall transparency of the law, so improving the data collection, getting agencies to update their websites, that kind of stuff. But then there's this whole other, how can we really get the CRA to do more in terms of, so on the community wealth building piece you talked about, asked me about earlier, I wanted to add that even if we get banks focused on community wealth building, if they are also engaged in other activities and increasing their reach in the capital markets in such a way that, you know, it brings about a financial crisis that strips wealth from communities, then what was all that investment for, right? And so we need to, at the same time, be expanding the CRA to not just deposit-taking institutions, but other online companies and the mortgage affiliates to really get the financial system more focused on equitable lending, and then also at the same time really bolstering the other financial regulations such as the Dodd-Frank Act that has been passed to make sure that the financial system as a whole is structurally sound, so we're not, even if we're making improvements to the CRA, that that's not just going to be stripped away in the form of financial crisis.
Exactly.
So one final piece, part of the legislative changes, that's where we could add in stricter enforcement mechanisms. Right now, the only enforcement mechanisms are you might get your charter status revoked, which hard to imagine that Wells Fargo would get its charter status revoked, or denials for mergers and acquisitions, which for a bank that's as big as Wells Fargo is maybe not the biggest deterrent to their activities or providing enough of an incentive. So, and that again would require legislative change because that is in the original letter of the law. This law applies to depository institutions. The mechanism by which we enforce the CRA is revoking the charter status and denying mergers and acquisitions.
In other words, you can't slap a multi-multi-billion-dollar fine on a bank.
No, not under the CRA.
Okay, that's important to know. John, what of those changes of the reforms that we've just talked about in the last couple of moments, and we're kind of running short on time, but of the reforms that we've talked about, what resonates with you?
Well, first, I want to say as the only non-mega bank on the phone here that, again, we as a bank can't compete against some of those bigger banks in regards to the amount of volume that we do, but we will put our 30-35% of all our disbursements against them any day and blow them out of the water. You know, I can't stress enough how important it is, and I applaud Devin for the paper that they wrote that I devoured yesterday, but you know, I think we're at this critical point where everyone needs to, during this comment period, comment and try to give their opinion or their thoughts on what works best. The only concern that I have is that right now, the FDIC and the Federal Reserve and the OCC are all on three different playing fields because the OCC has gone ahead and put this notice out by themselves. And so I hope that the Federal Reserve Bank and FDIC are also going to be able to work together for this CRA to be modernized, because it definitely does need to be modernized. And so a lot of what Devin said and a lot of the work that Gregory's doing on the ground all resonates with us as an organization, you know, around qualifying activities, around assessment areas and things of that nature. You know, we're all going to have to be held accountable, and so that it's not just a checkbox like the percentage that Devin gave around 90% of satisfactory. And so, you know, with that in mind, and you look at the work that we're trying to do around the cooperative development, but when you combine the community wealth piece there of trying to build their assets as a financial institution, I think the two things that we would like to see more help on, you know, obviously, listen, a lot of small business owners are aging out. Their families don't want to take over their businesses, and so they're converting to worker cooperatives. Great, but at the same time, those staff need to ensure that they have all the business skills needed for that business to remain successful from a staff standpoint and or governance. And then last but not least, there has to be access to this capital. And so one of the ways that we do that is that we try to partner with community development financial institutions or CDFIs, many of which are loan funds, credit unions, and or community development banks for us to expand our level of impact. Because again, not knocking them, but we're not one of those mega banks. And so we have to find ways to partner for our programs to be effective. So I just think that everything that Devin just listed there in regards to community development, having a bigger share, assessment areas, qualifying activities, it's all very important, and it all needs to be expressed during this very important comment period, because if we miss this opportunity, we may never get it again.
I'm going to give Devin the last word about that comment period, which ends November 19th. Can you succinctly tell listeners, if they go to regulations.gov and they look up the place, we'll provide the link, by the way, where people can go to make a comment, what is the most important point that they should make?
Sure. So the notice of proposed rulemaking asked for comments in several important areas. I think the biggest one that we want to be commenting on is to oppose the metric-based framework that's been proposed, which would reduce the CRA rating down to a ratio of the dollar amount of bank CRA activities divided by the bank assets. The reason that the ratio, we don't think the ratio would be compatible with community wealth building is that it would reduce evaluation to
a number.
Right. That is not, is limiting the local focus of the CRA and limiting the consideration of public comments on local performance, et cetera. So I would say is that a tremendous resource is the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, and they have put together a guide on how to comment. That's at their website, ncrc.org/treasurecra, where they have a template, they have instructions of how to go about making comments, where they provide some stock language around the metric. And some of the other proposals, including expanding the assessment areas. So that's one thing I didn't mention earlier, is that there is an opportunity to expand the assessment areas so that banks are evaluated on where they have the areas around which they have branches, but also areas where they don't have branches but are doing a significant amount of lending. And that's important because that's an opportunity to expand coverage without going through the legislative route. So that's an important area also on the OCC notice to be commenting on. And then it does ask for how can we expand CRA qualifying activities there. We want to put focus on lending to people of color, communities of color, community wealth building approaches, and a more kind of holistic definition of community and economic development. So those are kind of the three. You asked for one, but there are many. Three main areas: the assessment areas, the metric, and the qualifying activities.
Gregory, I want to give you 30 seconds to tell us what your community would look like if we got this right.
If we did CRA in a real, like, engaged way, I think, A, it would involve people on the ground in a more collaborative manner to say, like, hey, we can talk to our local banks. Even if the bank is a huge bank, like, build that relationship between folks on the ground, talk about the racial wealth gap and ways to build community ownership and wealth. And I think it could play a much more significant role in reducing displacement and increasing the capacity of folks in neighborhoods to solve their own problems, to be strong members of the community in a way that, like, through strong community ownership, that folks who've been working and struggling on the ground in the neighborhoods for a really long time get to reap the benefits of the improvements that have happened in our neighborhoods over the last couple decades.
And on that note, I want to thank all of my guests for being here on the Next System podcast. Listeners, want to remind you that you can get the Next System podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and wherever else you prefer to get your podcasts. And also you can find the Next System podcast on thenextsystem.org. Thank you very much for joining us. See you next time.